Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you for supporting independent bookstores and for supporting our author events. We really appreciate that. Well, I'm very excited tonight to get to meet and introduce Melanie Benjamin, who will talk about her new novel, The Autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb, because I loved Melanie's first novel, which was Alice I Have Been, and it focused on the life of the girl, Alice, who was the inspiration for Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. And I love historical fiction, and I love it when authors can kind of take the facts and also blend with dialogue and everything, and I hope you will too. And if you haven't read Alice I Have Been, I highly recommend it. And I'm right in the middle of the autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb, and I'm really enjoying it too. I love Vinny. I was really excited to hear when she announced she was writing another historical novel, and that it was about Mrs. Tom Thumb, Lavinia Bump's days in, well, Lavinia Warren Bump's days in show business, first under a not-so-nice man and then under P.T. Barnum, who maybe wasn't so nice at times either. And I don't know, I was kind of interested in Barnum's whole history, and I think he was just such a showman and con artist that it's always good to read about him. And she was one strong lady. So I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I have so far, and I'm really pleased to present Melanie Benjamin. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be in Colorado. I was just telling Lisa that I come here every year. I go up to Estes Park for a week-long writing retreat. That's where I write the bulk of my novels, actually. And I was just here in late April, early May. So this is like feels like I'm coming home. I just wish I could have time to go up and drive into the mountains. But, well, I'm so excited to finally be able to talk about this woman whose extraordinary story I tell in the autobiography of Mrs. Tom Thumb. But before I do, I wanted to show you all something, which I know makes a riveting podcast, but I'm sorry, I need a visual here. All right, Mercy Lavinia Warren Bump Stratton McGree stood 32 inches tall, if you can visualize that. Now, I have spent a great deal of time trying to see the world through her eyes, imagining what life was like through eyes not even 3 feet off the ground. And whether I succeeded or not, I hope you'll tell me after you read the book. But I look at this, and I know the life she led and the times she lived in, and I'm still not quite sure how she did it. And let me tell you a little bit about how I came to write the book, or as I like to say, how I nearly ruined my career. Alice I Have Been was my first novel of historical fiction, and it was the first of a two-book contract with Random House, and I was halfway through writing that second book. I had about 50,000 words done, the deadline was 4 months away, when I realized that the person whose story I was trying to tell was a bit of a sap, actually. I fell out of love with her in a very big way. I could not continue telling her story. So before I told my editor this and gave her a heart attack, I thought I should perhaps have another idea and maybe a chapter or two already written to send her. So I knew I wanted to write an American story this time, since Alice had been set in England, and I wanted to keep it in the Victorian era because it is an era that interests me. So I just started Googling lists of famous American women, women of the 1800s, and on one of these lists, the name Lavinia Warren Stratton, or Mrs. Tom Thumb, came out. It kind of caught my eye. And I remembered the name because I had read about her already in the pages of E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime, which is one of my favorite historical novels. And in that book, she has a very brief scene with Harry Houdini. And I remembered it being very feisty even in that. So I did a quick search of her name, and I was immediately entranced. First of all, it was so apparent that she had been such a famous woman in her time. Her celebrity really, it rivaled that of the Civil War. It kind of superseded it in one way. And she was one of the most photographed women of her age, yet today, you know, she's all but forgotten. And then I found some of her autobiographical writings she had left behind. She had intended to publish an autobiography in her lifetime, but never did. She had a couple of essays published and left behind a collection of notes, basically. And so I was reading these notes, and as I did, her voice just kind of it leapt up off the page and wormed its way into my ear, and I could not get it out. So I sat down and I began to write this. I suppose it would be fashionable to admit to some reservations as I undertake to write the history of my life. Popular memoirs of our time suggest a certain reticence is expected, particularly when the author is a female. We women are timid creatures, after all. We must retire behind a veil of secrecy and allow others to tell our stories. To that, I can only reply, rubbish. I have let others, one other, in particular, tell my story for far too long. Now is the time to set the record straight, to sort out the humbug from the truth, and vice versa. And I continued like that for a couple of chapters, and I sent them off to my editor, and to my great relief, she loved them. And with her blessing, I sat down and I wrote a 150,000-word novel in 5 months. I don't recommend that for everyone, but fear can be a powerful motivator. Now, as I researched her life, there were two things that really kind of stood out to me. And first was, in those writings that she left behind, it was what she didn't say that intrigued me. In all her public, you know, persona and the writing, everything written about her, she presents such a determined, optimistic, stubborn in a way, but just very public, ladylike face in which she never encounters an obstacle. She never meets a person who is rude or unkind to her. She never has heartbreak or tragedy. And obviously, that could not be true. And she was just such a public person. But occasionally, she would let slip that mask just a little bit to give us a glimpse. And for example, she did write about her frustration and always being picked up and patted and hugged as if she were a child and not a 20-year-old woman. And it was those little glimpses that were tantalizing to me. And they really made me want to kind of tiptoe behind her on stage and lift that curtain up and see what she was hiding. And the other thing was simply the time in which she lived. I really came to see Vinnie's story as the story of America in those go west young man years. America in the mid-1800s, despite the fact that there was a civil war going on, it was an America of incredible growth and opportunity and optimism in a way. It was manifest destiny, and we had the whole continent to conquer. All you had to do is go find it. Inventions were happening one right after the other. The cotton gin, the telegraph, the railroad, the telephone, electricity, and Vinnie witnessed it all. And it really just was an America of such optimism, and there was always a new opportunity as long as you were willing to pack up your bag and go find it. And that was Vinnie. So Mercy Lavinia Warren Bump was born in 1841. She was one of 7 or 8 siblings. All her siblings and her parents all grew to full adult size, except her younger sister by 7 years, Minnie. Vinnie and Minnie were both born normal-sized babies. They stopped growing somewhat around the age of one, and then grew sporadically after that. They had a form of proportionate dwarfism, in which every limb was in perfect proportion. We suspect today that they had a pituitary disorder, and that were they born today, she would have been given human growth hormone so that maybe she wouldn't be full adult size, but she certainly would be taller than 32 inches. And in fact, in modern societies today, that kind of dwarfism is really very rare today because of the human growth hormone. You do see it somewhat in less developed nations. The type of dwarfism that seems familiar to us today is achondroplasia, which is a disproportionate dwarfism. So for a woman of Vinnie's time, there were really only two choices in life. One was marriage. The other was basically being the spinster aunt living on the kindness of your family. And for, you know, for Vinny being 32 inches tall, I mean, one of those options was not available to her, probably marriage. So she was expected to live a life protected by her family, and she had a very loving family. She had a very happy childhood. Her parents were simple farmers from Massachusetts. She was very proud that on her mother's side they were descended from the Mayflower. She never failed to mention that. And, you know, they loved her, and they wanted to shelter her and keep her safe. And her mother, in fact, didn't even want to send her to school. But Vinny, at the age of 7 or 8, put her foot down and demanded to be allowed to go to school with her brothers and sisters. And there she thrived. And she was so intelligent that when she was 16, she was offered the position of school teacher in her small town. And so for a year, she was a school teacher teaching children, obviously much taller than she. And, you know, that in itself would be enough to make her life extraordinary for that time. But it was not enough for Vinny. And when she was 17, after her first school year as school teacher, opportunity came knocking on the door in the form of a cousin, or a man claiming to be a cousin anyway. He had heard of his extraordinary little cousin and had come to offer her a position on his floating palace of curiosities, which was a very fancy name for a showboat, and a kind of seedy showboat at that. And of course, Vinny's, you know, pious, respectable family were, you know, appalled and said, and said, no, of course, this is not going to happen. But of course, Vinny said, yes, 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 it is. And after a stormy night of tears and anguish, during which one of her brothers actually said he would leave home forever if she insisted upon displaying herself in such a public manner, Vinny left home the next morning. 17 years old, 32 inches tall, leaving home for the first time in the company of a total stranger to travel under the most primitive conditions imaginable west to the Mississippi River. She was able to do this for two reasons. One was her size, obviously. At least at this point in her life, she seemed very aware that her size was the reason she was of interest, and that it was her kind of passport out to a different world. Later on, I think she forgot that. I think she forgot why people were interested in her, but at least at that time she knew. The other reason she was able to do this was because of a man named P.T. Barnum. And we obviously know Barnum today for the circus that still bears his name. But he was actually famous long, long before the circus. That was like the last thing he did at the end of his life. Phineas Taylor Barnum was born in 1810. He was, among various things, a shopkeeper, a newspaper editor. He ran a lottery, and I think it was kind of a shady lottery at that. But he soon discovered he had a talent for selling people things they didn't even know they needed. And America in that time was an America just waking up to itself. It had been a collection of very isolated rural communities prior to the advent of the railroad. But with the railroad, suddenly everyone was linked, and people were reading newspapers from different villages, and they were aware that there were things they had never heard about or dreamed about, and it awakened a great thirst for the new and the novel and the different. And Barnum had a genius for collecting the new, the novel, and the different. He first came to fame when he found an 80-something-year-old elderly former slave woman named Joyce Heth. He basically put her in a wagon and trundled her from town to town and told people she was the 161-year-old former nursemaid to George Washington. But people believed him. And that was his first humbug. He never saw any harm in telling a few whoppers if it made people happy. And it did make people happy. So soon he was collecting all sorts of curiosities. That was the word used in those days. The words freak show were not in the lexicon at this point. Not only people, but things. And he collected them all, and he displayed them all in his American Museum. And it's a shame that Barnum's American Museum is all but forgotten today. It really was, and the only way you can describe it was the Disney World of its time. It was the first entertainment palace. It was an enormous building in the middle of Broadway, of Manhattan. It was on the corner of Broadway and Ann. It was about 6 stories tall, painted white with his name all over it, because he put his name on everything. And on the side, he painted these very vivid paintings of all the wonders that you might see inside. And then, and this is why I love Barnum so much, he hired a band to sit outside on a balcony and play music, but he hired them to play very badly. He wanted them to play out of tune and out of step in order to drive everyone outside the museum inside, where they had to pay admission. And once inside, then they saw an amazing collection of things. The very first aquarium in the United States was in Barnum's American Museum. There were waxworks, dioramas. There was a tree, the stump of a tree under which Jesus supposedly sat. In display cases, there were collections of meteors and rocks and petrified pieces of wood. One of the most famous displays was the Fiji mermaid, which was basically the torso of a dead monkey sewn to the tail of a dead fish. And yeah, and displayed in a glass case. I do not imagine it smelled very good at all. And then he had this enormous lecture hall. Now, back in those days, you could not use the word theater or stage. People, genteel people, would not set foot in a theater. You, however, could call the same thing a lecture hall. Occasionally have a few lectures on it, but have theatrical productions, and that was okay. And one of the very first productions of Uncle Tom's Cabin was performed in Barnum's lecture hall in the American Museum. He also brought over the very famous Swedish opera singer Jenny Lind, called her the Swedish Nightingale. She performed there. But the most famous performer in those days was 36-inch tall General Tom Thumb. Now, Charles Stratton was the name, his name. Like Vinny, whom he would marry, he was born a normal-sized baby who just stopped growing. Unlike Vinny, though, he really didn't have a choice in the life he led. You know, Vinny sought her fame. She sought her life. Charles was not even 5 years old when Barnum heard about him, heard about this extraordinary small little boy in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he went to see him, and he basically talked the child's parents into giving him the 5 year old. He taught him to sing, he taught him to dance, to mimic, do impersonations. And then he decided that a 5 year old small child isn't that interesting. He added a few years to his age and called him an 11 year old. And taught him then to converse with adults and take wine at table and even eventually smoke cigars. And he christened him General Tom Thumb. Then Barnum decided he would take him to Europe. As Barnum himself said, Americans have such a disgraceful preference for the European. So Barnum had it in his mind, and we still do, actually. And Barnum had it in his mind that if he could take him over to Europe and maybe get one of the many royal people over there to embrace this performer, he could bring him back to the United States as this European, this royal favorite. And that is what happened. Queen Victoria fell in love with the little tap dancing prodigy. I mean, he was a very gifted performer. He was a good mimic, and he did everything that Barnum wanted him to do. And Queen Victoria was charmed by him and invited him to the palace where he met her family, and she gave him a miniature carriage, which he used to the end of his life. And so Barnum brought him back to the United States and said, Queen Victoria's favorite, General Tom Thumb. And yes, he was a huge success. And they toured the country, and then he performed on stage at the American Museum. And he got so wealthy, he was able to retire in his early 20s. And here's an interesting part about Barnum that I find very charming, actually. He gets a lot of flack today for exploiting some of these performers. And yes, he did. He got wealthy from doing so, but so did they. And in some cases, he gave them a life, you know, better than what they would have expected otherwise. But they also became friends. And particularly between Charles Stratton and Barnum, there grew a very strong friendship. They vacationed together. They stayed at each other's houses. There was a great affection between them. And when Barnum went through one of his periodical bankruptcies, which he was always doing, he was always making and losing fortunes, Charles came out of retirement, not because he needed the money, but because his good friend Barnum needed the money. So when she left home, she was very much aware of General Tom Thumb and P.T. Barnum. So she knew this was an avenue open to her. So she left home and she started her performing career in 1858 on the Mississippi Showboat. And it was, quite frankly, a rude awakening. She had left a family and a community in which she was loved and respected. And the Mississippi River was a different crowd. I mean, it was very rough and wild in 1858, 1859. It was kind of the edge of America. Those riverboat crowds were rough. They were not above bringing, you know, the tomatoes on stage to throw on stage, shooting, actually, at the boat from the shores of the river. They did that. And she experienced for the first time the other side of well, just the disrespect of people not used to her and the roughness. But she learned a lot. And as this troupe of mostly northern performers were floating up and down the Mississippi from Minnesota to New Orleans and back in these years leading up to the Civil War, she seemed to meet almost every person who would soon become famous. She met a man named Ulysses S. Grant when he was just a shopkeeper in Galena, Illinois. He brought his family to meet her, to see her perform. And she met Jefferson Davis when he was just a senator from Mississippi before he was president of the Confederacy. But it was a hard life, and when the Civil War intervened, putting a stop to their travels, I think she was probably relieved. So the war started, and she came home, and at least two of her brothers fought in the war. And I'm sure her parents finally said, okay, enough. You got that out of your system. Now you're home to stay, right? Well, no, not Vinnie. It was during these years that she came to the attention of Barnum. We don't know exactly how she came to the attention of Barnum. I have my theories. They're in the book. But in late 1862, Barnum sent for her. And her parents once more said, no, no way. You are not going with this man, Barnum, this teller of humbugs. They were very upset about his reputation as a liar. And once more, Vinnie had her way. And so in early 1863, she appeared on stage at the American Museum for the very first time. And this began the great adventure and, I think, the great relationship of her life. I think in Barnum, she finally met her match. You know, here was someone whose imagination and creativity and dreams were as big as her own. And they hit it off immediately. And he presented her in the way she saw herself, which was simply a perfect lady. He advertised her as the little queen of beauty, the perfect woman in miniature, and that was all he did to allude to her size. She was gowned in the most exquisite of fashions and jewels, and she basically was just this perfectly mannered, well-bred lady of good breeding. She told a few stories, she shook hands a lot, she sang a few popular songs, and New York fell in love with her. But they weren't the only ones. She'd only been on stage at the American Museum for just a few weeks before she was engaged to Charles Stratton or General Tom Thumb. There's a lot of debate on how happy and how genuine their marriage was. They seem to at least have affection for each other, but it's hard for me not to imagine that either Barnum or Vinnie or some combination of the two saw the box office potential. One little person is interesting, but two can be a phenomenon, and that is what happened. When they announced their engagement, America went crazy. I mean, we've just been through the whole royal wedding thing, right, with Kate and William, and before them, Charles and Diana. They had nothing on Charles and Vinny. America, this is the dark years of the Civil War. It's 1863. I think America needed a diversion. They were heartsick from seeing casualty lists in the newspapers every day. And no one knew when the war was going to win or end, or if it was going to win to end. So they just embraced this miniature romance. And just like with Kate and William, every detail of Vinnie's trousseau and wedding dress were highly anticipated. The most famous dressmakers of the time fought to create her wedding gown. Astors and Vanderbilts fought to see who would give them the biggest wedding present. President Lincoln and Mary Lincoln invited them to the White House for a reception on their honeymoon journey, and indeed they went. And really, for a time, they knocked the Civil War off the front pages. So the wedding party consisted of Charles and Vinnie, obviously, but then Vinnie's younger sister and smaller sister, Minnie. Minnie was only 28 inches tall. Minnie was her bridesmaid. And another little person who was a performer with Barnum, Commodore Nutt, was Charles's best man. So you had this miniature quartet. And while Vinnie was able to persuade Barnum not to sell tickets to the wedding, she was not able to persuade him not to sell tickets to the reception, and he charged $75 a person. And the wedding party shook hands with their guests while perched on top of a piano. That was the only way they could greet them all. An interesting thing happened in this country after this, and it was called the Tom Thumb Wedding. Have any of you ever heard of a Tom Thumb wedding? Okay. Churches and schools primarily would hold pageants in which children basically dressed up in wedding clothes and pretended to get married. And these were usually fundraisers. And it kind of reached its peak in the 1930s and 40s. But the other day I was speaking with a book club about Alice, actually, but I started talking about this book, and one of the women suddenly remembered she had been in a Tom Thumb wedding in the 1950s. And just the other day, on a whim, I Googled Tom Thumb wedding. There are still Tom Thumb weddings being performed in this country somewhere today. So Google it. You will see it. And I'm not really sure what to make of that. I'm not sure what Vinny would have made of that either. But after the wedding, you know, it seemed a shame to break up such a perfect little group of people. So they decided to form the General Tom Thumb Company. They kind of performed on their own. They broke away from Barnum. He was still a partner in it, and he helped them manage it. But basically on their own now, they were touring. They toured Canada and Europe and England, where Vinny finally met the Queen. And they came back to the United States, and after the war was over, they went immediately to the South. I mean, literally, plantations were still smoking when they went down there to tour. And they encountered the newly formed KKK once in Tennessee. They had kind of a scary encounter with them. And then in 1869, they left on their most famous adventure, which was their 3 years tour around the world. They were one of the first passengers on the brand new Transcontinental Railroad. You know, the Golden Spike had been driven in June of 1869. They left in late July. And, you know, they shot buffalo from the windows, and they were welcomed to Utah themselves by Brigham Young. And they were nearly held up by bandits on a stagecoach, and they visited the mining towns. And then they left from San Francisco to journey by steamship to the Orient and the Far East. They even saw Australia. So they truly became kind of the first world-famous performers. And in those days, they literally had to travel the world to become world-famous. And I won't go into all the details. They're in the book. But just two things I keep in mind. I'm in the middle of my own. I call it my epic book tour, because I left home a week ago today, and I won't be home again until Saturday. And, you know, it's fun, it's exciting, but travel these days has always got its frustrations, you know, TSA, and what if I lose my luggage, and what if I miss my plane? Well, the truth is, if I lose my luggage, I can always go to a store and buy something new. If I miss a plane, there's always going to be another one. When they left home, they knew it was going to be years before they saw their loved ones, maybe even years before letters could catch up with each other. They had to travel with 3 years' worth of clothing and accessories. For starters, they did not know what they were going to encounter. I mean, some of these places were so new and so unexplored. I mean, they had no idea how they were sometimes going to travel from one place to another. Some places didn't have telegraph. So that if they didn't know if they were going to be able to find places where they could get clothing or accessories. And they, even if they could have, they could never just go into a store and buy something, because everything had to be custom made. Particularly, you know, they always wore the most fashionable of clothing. And, you know, for Vinny and Minnie, that meant custom made corsets and crinolines and hoop skirts and then bustles. And so they had to carry all that with them. They also had to travel with a group of managers and adults to help them, full-size adults to help them. For one thing, they were a theatrical troupe, so there were props and, you know, scenery that had to go along with them, and the box office proceeds. And, you know, this was in the day when there weren't banks everywhere. They actually had to carry the proceeds from each performance with them for quite a long time. So their manager slept with a strong box under his bed and a pistol under his pillow. But they needed these people simply to lift them up and on and off trains and boats, and sometimes into bed at night. And so that's something I'm going to remember and keep with me as I'm on this tour. I'm going to try not to complain too much if I have to wait a little extra in line for security tomorrow at the airport. I could go on and on about the history, and I'm a history nerd, you can tell. But one thing I have learned as a historical novelist is that actually history is the least important part of the book. Really, the book has to be about the people and the relationships, their dreams, their hopes, the things that we can relate to across the ages. And, you know, Vinny's personal life was just as vivid as the history she witnessed. She paid a dear price for choosing to live the life she led. And one of the persons, unfortunately, she ended up hurting the most was the person she loved the most, and that was her sister, Minnie. You know, Vinny and Barnum were cut from the same bowl of cloth. They were tough as nails. But Minnie, and to a lesser extent, Charles, were different. They were more childlike, innocent, they got hurt more. And one interesting parallel to explore between Vinny's fame and the kind of fame we seem to see today sometimes in reality TV is that there came a point when Vinny, I think, got confused as to what was real life and what was pretend. On stage, in front of people, that was where she came alive, but she was really only pretending to be a wife, to be a mother at one point on stage. And off stage, she seemed stunted and unable to engage and not really live this life. And ironically, it was Minnie, who was much more timid on stage, who would have been happy to stay at home all her life, who had the courage to live the life, fully live the life, that Vinnie was only pretending to. And she paid a very dear price for that. In the late 1870s, Minnie was no longer part of the act. Commodore Nutt was no longer part of the act. So it was just Charles and Vinnie still out there, still touring. But tastes had changed and audiences had changed. And now you're beginning to hear the words freak and freak show and sideshow. But Vinnie and Charles, well, Vinnie could never stay still, but they were always hard up for money. They lived way too extravagantly. They lived to compete on the same scale as their good friends, the Astors and the Vanderbilts, but they didn't have their wealth. So they had to keep performing. And in 1881, Barnum had by now gotten into the circus business. He offered them a job performing with his circus. So they for one season and one season only, performed with Barnum's circus. The only thing Vinnie wrote about that time was simply, "It was not to our taste." And that's all she said. They were no longer the headliners. They were no longer the good friends of kings and queens. They were literally in the sideshow alley performing with the buskers and the carnies and all that. So they didn't do another season with the circus. And then in 1883, Charles died. He was only 46. So Vinnie was 43. And for the first time, you know, she seemed to lose her verve. She seemed to waver a bit. And she returned home to Massachusetts, and she declared that she would now just stay home and she would no longer appear before the public. But there was one person left in her life who knew her better than she knew herself. And that person, well, one day there came another knock on her door, and it was P.T. Barnum. And he was convinced that if she remained home, she would wither away and die. And he convinced her to come back out and appear before her public. And indeed she did. Now, I chose to end this book a good 40 years before Vinnie died. I didn't intend that. I thought I was going to follow her all the way through her life, but her life was so enormous. I was afraid this was going to be a 5 million page book. One thing I have, she did continue to perform. She married again, another little person. She even appeared in a silent film 4 years before her death in 1919. But in her own writings, the notes she left behind, she only gave those 40 years about 3 pages. It was so clear that her heart and her soul were back in the days when she was Mrs. General Tom Thumb, and that is how she signed herself to the end of her life, and with P.T. Barnum. One other thing I have learned as a novelist is that every life is made up of 1,000 stories. Yours is, mine is. And it's the novelist's job to pick and choose which handful of stories will create a compelling novel. And as I was doing this with Vinnie, one story just kept coming to the forefront, and it was the story of her relationship with Barnum. And I truly came to believe that he was the driving force in her life, the light she was always seeking and always seeking to return to. So I closed my book with the close of their story. And it was the story of these two larger-than-life personalities. But of the two, I really believe it was the 32-inch tall Vinnie who had the bigger life and the bigger heart. And she certainly captured mine, and I hope she captures yours as well. So thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.